Jimmy, I think it was maybe 2 weeks ago, Jimmy reached out to me to do this. And I was like, dude, I just did one of these. Like, no one wants to hear from me that much. And, I hope I end a little early because I'm much more interested in what you guys have to say about this thing. But, I mean, I think the role, and I don't know who I got it from. There's a lot of guys that I follow around in this program that have taught me a lot. But the rule I was taught was like, you don't say no. Like, it's not an option. Like, you could think it, you can't say no. Like, no, you got to show up. They ask you to show up, you show up. And I kind of apply that to everything in my life. If I could do it, I try to do it. And that's the difference these days, right? Like, I actually show up, not just like the tiny 5'6", 5'7", body in front of you with questionable resources, but no, like the mental part shows up too. Like I'm there, hopefully somewhat shaved, well rested, caffeinated, not dressed like a homeless person, ready to do whatever it is you ask me to do. That's a pretty big difference. I was thinking a couple hours ago this morning, actually. I like many of us drink probably too much coffee. And I wasn't paying attention this morning. I went to bed late and got up early driving. And when I drive, I try not to drink too much coffee because I don't have to pee every 15 minutes. So I did my first pit stop a couple of hours ago and went to the washroom. And I got back in the car and I sat down and I had to pee again. I was like, how is that possible? Like, I just peed. I was just there. Like, I did it. I know it came out. Like, how is that? Maybe I'm just getting older. Maybe I drank too much coffee. I don't know. But it made me think about being uncomfortable. And I have like a chronology. I wrote like a little thing. I find like when I do these talks lately that I get lost. And I just start talking about who knows what. And I want to be respectful of the people on this meeting and and hopefully offer my story and offer something that's a benefit or what have you. But I feel like my brain wanders and it might be germane to anything. The other thing I do that I find funny is I'll tell a story in response to something that you told me, but I won't actually say what the through line is. Like I just assume like you've been paying attention, I've been paying attention, like you know what the through line is, right? But I don't actually plot it out, and I think a good orator should point that out, right? Just in case you missed it. And that's the thing. Like, I like to think I'm a decent orator. I could tell a story, or I could talk to anybody about a lot of different things, have a lot of interests. Basically, since like February, March, I've been thinking to myself, like, you're not that good of an orator. You're kind of a lunatic and all over the place. And I've been questioning myself, right? I was photographing a wedding a couple weeks ago, and I was working for somebody else. And we go to the hotel room. I've never met these guys before in my life, same-sex couple. And we have like a minute. We're just like introducing ourselves to the client and everything. And I go, man, I got to tell you guys, I love same-sex marriages, particularly gay ones. And the guy I'm working for is kind of looking at me like, where the hell is he going to go with this? And I go, the thing is about dudes, like you two gay dudes, like you're here and we can take pictures and the hotel is immaculate. Everything's put away, everything is in its place, it's perfect. If there were women here, there'd be stuff all over the room. We wouldn't be able to photograph in any direction. And we all had a chuckle and got on with our lives. But the guy I was working for, you could see the terror in his eye. Like what ridiculous thing is gonna come out of this guy's mouth? And a couple things on that is, back in the day, not too long ago, there was no telling what was going to come out of my mouth. I'd say things to incriminate myself and speak poorly and embarrass my wife and people I'm with. And I never thought anything of it. I just keep the pedal to the metal and just keep going. Like, what? There was a pause there? I didn't hear the pause. There was a pause. And the other thing, or the other side to that is this level of uncomfortability. Like, I wrote this list, these bullet points, because I'm uncomfortable. I'm uncomfortable talking to you. I'm uncomfortable doing public speaking. I'm uncomfortable most of the time in my own skin and my own shoes. And I was thinking about that this morning, and I was thinking, you know, that was at least one of the reasons you used to drink, right? Like you were uncomfortable. I have this like philosophy in life now. I don't, you know, like anything. I don't. I'm not great at observing it all the time, but I have this thought or this theory that, like, if you're uncomfortable, good. You should be uncomfortable. Like that's a good thing. If you're comfortable all the time, like, how do you know what's going on? Like it's healthy, I feel like, to be on the edge, teetering a little bit, you know? Like if you didn't feel that way, maybe there'd be something wrong with you. Maybe you're sedated. You're not really living life, you know? You're talking to someone, you're interacting with someone, like you're conscious. You understand what's going around, understand that there's risks in what you're doing, and you're respectful of the people and the things around you. So you should feel uncomfortable. I don't know, I kind of love that. And I feel uncomfortable a lot. So my first little bullet point here says, I used to be fearful of what I thought life would be like in the beginning when I was like kind of realized that I had a problem. I was like, all right, you have a problem. You need to do something about this thing. Like it's not going well for you. I'm not sure how it's going to end, but like it's not good. And I think that we should probably do something about this. And you know, the thought in my head was like, but like I'm missing out on all these great like things. Like I don't know how I'm going to live my life without alcohol. Like it makes me back to that analogy of uncomfortability. Like it makes me comfortable. It doesn't make you comfortable. It makes you numb. You're not living life. And but I was really afraid. I was like terrified of like what people thought of me, what I was going to say, what I was going to miss. I think it's referenced in one of our readings, the conviviality. Like my life was so convivial when I was, you know, drinking, you know, martinis and roarous laughter, that dining room that Bill talked about, you know, the bar. I'm going to miss all that. Like that's going to go away.
I
And
got my blood pressure
man,
taken.
what's that? I don't think that anything could be further from the truth as far as, you know, what my life was like as far as that conviviality goes. When I was 13 thereabouts, I smashed a bottle over my own head at a party, you know, and ended up in the hospital having my stomach pumped. I think about sometimes about a parent. I don't have kids, but I could imagine what it would be like for a parent, an alcoholic parent, no less, to see their kid, you know, with their head wrapped, bandaged in a tube down their throat, you know, all messed up. And you know, the thing about that is like I think most people that happens to ordinary normies, as we might call them, that happens to a normie, and they're like, I'm good. Like I'm never gonna drink again. Like that's it, it's over. But like I was out the next weekend, you know what I mean? I got my teeth knocked out by a police officer. I got into a fist fight with a police officer down in the Bowery and got my teeth knocked out, my face beat up pretty good. They didn't arrest me. Maybe that was the one plus side to that. I talk about it sometimes. Like I'm a pretty tiny guy, but I think I could fight the police. It doesn't end well. Countless drunken fights with my wife, threatening to leave, talking about how she's not good enough. Just, I don't know. Just the countless mailings that I had gotten into. Ironically, we're coming up on our 20-year anniversary. I'm going to be traveling. I'm going to be away. Good on me. I hid a little gift for her at the house. And so I'm hoping that saves my bacon a little bit. But 20 years, she hasn't left. Man, I don't, I constantly wonder about that. She keeps me in check. She keeps me on point. But you know, I say all that just because that's what it was like. I mean, this whole notion of being uncomfortable and being numb to the world. I drank through her cancer. She had breast cancer about the same time that I got sober. She ended treatment. I drank through her cancer. I wasn't there for her. You know, how do you reconcile that? What amends list does that end up on? And you know, to mention that is funny that you go through the steps. I've been through the steps, I don't know, at this point, maybe a dozen times, maybe more. And you know, you apologize. I apologize. I apologize. And sometimes the verbiage comes from my wife that's the same that it was when I was drinking. It terrifies me. What's different this time? Yeah, you're sorry. What are you sorry about? Do you even know the damage you did? What's different? What's changed? How have you changed? What are you going to do differently? And again, I don't know about you guys, but I like, oh, I'm going to go to rehab. I'm going to monitor my drinking. Look, I've got a flow chart, a Venn diagram. It's going to be great. Like, now this time we got, you know. You know, and these days I talk about like, well, I'm speaking at a meeting this morning. You know, I meditated this morning. I'm going to talk to my sponsor. I don't know how good of a job I'm doing. You'd have to ask her, but there isn't a level of effort there that I'm attempting. I'm working at. Real quick here, I got a note about my mom and my dad. I lost both my mom and my dad in sobriety. My dad's dad drank. He was an alcoholic, World War II CB. He used to beat his wife and kids. That must have been a good time. My dad didn't beat us. He only beat me a couple of times, and I definitely deserved it. I was a little punk-ass kid. But, you know, he drank. He was an alcoholic. He had this thing. And I remember when I was locked in, I was drinking and passing out on a loop. I couldn't get out of it. And I would call him drunk. Some of you guys have heard this story, but I'd call him. And I remember this one time calling him and saying that I hate you. I can't stand you. I hate your guts, you know? And he's like, you know, and then I'm like, you know, but I love you. You know, like all of my mechanical aptitude, my ability to talk to people about whatever confidence I have in the world, the notion to try things and be willing to fail, that all comes from him. Maybe he had those qualities to a fault, but I inherited some of them, you know? And I said, you know, I hate you for all, you know, my alcoholism and my temper and, you know, all these things I wanted to blame him for. I was like, I hate you for those, but I love you for the other thing. And he goes to me, he goes, yeah, I appreciate that. I really appreciate you saying that. Like, that's not the response I was expecting at all. And he's like, you know, I didn't get to tell my dad that I loved him. He died in my arms. He had a heart attack. He died in my arms. I never got to tell him I loved him. I only got to tell him I hated him. And the other one that makes me tear up a little bit is my mom. My mom, they both died of lung cancer. And I've got a nice little cigar habit going right now that I should probably work on. But my mom, I got down to see my mom, and, you know, she's on like a regimen of pain meds, essentially. She was cognizant when I got there, but within 2 or 3 days, she basically was in a chemical stupor and was kind of in and out of consciousness. And I was there for about 10 days. And on the last day, I had to get back to Buffalo. I had other obligations. I'm leaving. Of course, I felt horrible. But I'm leaving. And I like hugged her feet, her cold feet in that bedroom. And I said, I love you, mom. And she's in a coma. She says, I love you too. Don't drink. Like, what? And then went back to bed. So that stays with me. That's always good for a little tear. You always think like, I'm not going to tear. I got to say those words. Like, oh. But again, it's great. It's great to be able to say that and feel something. You know, if I was drinking, I'd probably be drinking and driving. The driving part wouldn't inhibit me from telling the story, but the tears and the emotion side of it, I wouldn't feel. I'd run right past them because I don't feel feelings. They're numb. Now I feel them. I feel the uncomfortability. And I try, if I can, I try to embrace it. I shot a wedding yesterday in Rochester. And I thought it was pretty funny to me. I had a chuckle. Maybe you'll get a chuckle. I don't know. It's no feedback. It's just me talking. So that's kind of interesting. But I have my car, and everything was at the same venue. It's like a farm. And I'm going to my car to like switch out a piece of equipment or something. I don't remember. But I have coffee, cold brew, in like one of those thermoses, you know. And I'm taking a swig of the cold brew while I'm grabbing the equipment and going back to shooting whatever I'm shooting. I take like a swig of this cold, you know, and then, you know, whatever, get on with my day or whatever. But I was thinking to myself, Like it used to be airplane bottles of vodka. That wasn't that long ago. It wasn't too long ago, I would be taking swigs of vodka out of my car, out of my photo bag, and then go back to work. Now, one time I was stumbling, I dropped the camera and I got fired from that job, you know. One time I opened the bag and all the airplane bottles went flying all over the place and no one saw it, I don't think. But you know, it's kind of difficult to keep that under wraps, you know, not to mention what your physical appearance and your ability to do your job. But those days, like, they're behind me. They're behind me. I'm living a different life. I'm a different person. As a lot of you guys know, I'm a pretty big motorcycle enthusiast. I love motorcycles. This is the Zen art of motorcycle maintenance. I just took a pretty long motorcycle trip across this country, which was just in and of itself incredible to have the ability to do that, have the time, just all of it, the physicality, the places that I went and saw, the people that I met, the feeling of it. I think it's said in the Zen art of motorcycle maintenance that when you're in a car and you're driving through the world like I am now, you're in the car, you're seeing the world through the glass. When you're on a motorcycle, you're in it, you're in the world. I'll make two quick analogies to my alcoholism, but you know, one of them is that in my sobriety, I'm in the world now. I am a participating member of society, and this program allows me to do that. I did not have that before. I had 25 years of isolation and just basically cluelessness. Some of that was my age, and the other part of it was just being completely numb and sheltered from the world. And the other analogy, I apologize if I've already made it once before, but I like it. I got to do a couple of motorcycle track days. You take the bike to a track, and it's got to go through like an inspection to make sure nothing's going to fall off of it and injure somebody else. And you know, you wear like this leather suit. You know, there's a rating. You know, they let you go out with a different group. I'm a beginner. I've only been out twice, and it's such an interesting experience. I think if you've never been on a track before, especially on a motorcycle's tiny. You're tiny, right? And the track is, you think, pretty tiny also. But when you get out there, when I get out there, I feel completely lost. Completely lost. You know, you go through basically with like a pace car, and the instructor is pointing out the cones. And the cones mean either braking, you know, where you start to brake, or where you turn in is what they call an apex. And you're looking for one cone, and then from one cone to the other, you're supposed to aim, point the bike, turn in, aim the bike. We call it the apex. And then there's flags. What do the flags mean? And there's different flags on the track, and you need to look for those flags. And they tell you different things that might be going on. There's body signals and other things or whatever. But my point is you go out there on the track, and you're lost. I'm completely lost on that track. It feels huge. And they go around and you go a couple laps and they're pointing stuff out. And then they start to go a little faster and a little bit faster. And me being the lunatic that I am, you guys have met me or heard me talk before, is like, I want to go full bore, man. I want to do 100 miles an hour right away. And, you know, the instructor, the last time I went out, the instructor, it was a whole other kerfuffle, but the instructor was in front of me. So he's hammering it pretty good. And I hammer it. I'm trying to keep up with them. And there's a sensation that you've probably had in your car where, like, if you miss a turn, your body, like, your center of gravity tells you, like, uh-oh, I messed up. Like, this is going to hurt. Like, I'm going to go off the road here and probably crash into something. I'm going to lose it. Like, I'm going to lose it. It's going to be bad. And in my head, I'm always thinking, like, what am I going to hit? What am I going to crash into? Is that guardrail going to tear my arms off? How do I avoid the guard? Can I jump over the guardrail? Like, these are the things that go through my head. This isn't Well People's Anonymous. So, yeah, but so, you know, you start to go a little too fast on the track, and you get this sensation that I'm out of position. I missed the turn. I missed the braking zone. Like, I'm going to go off. Like, this is, I'm off. But this last time I went out, I realized something. First of all, it's my own race, right? Like, I don't have to go full bore. I'm not racing anyone. You know, you can try to have some fun and keep up with that, with the instructor. And I'm trying to learn something out there. I'm trying to learn myself, my body, the motorcycle, the braking, you know, the different pivot points, I'm trying to learn, like, you know, when you get to that position, you lose control. How do you calm down? How do you not lock up the brakes? How do you stay in control? How do I maintain composure and not crash and not wreck? And if I follow that instructor and I do what he does, I brake when he brakes, I turn the bike in when he turns in, everything's okay. I don't have to work that hard. I don't have to think that hard. I mean, yeah, you can enjoy it. You're going to feel a little over your skis, get that little adrenaline, that little fear, like, hey, I messed up. But, like, it's okay. Just calm down. Trust him. Trust yourself. Trust the bike. You're doing what you're supposed to be doing. For me, that's Alcoholics Anonymous. That's what the program is for me. When I get too far, and I've been working. I've been traveling. I've been doing different things. I'm in a car right now. My stepmom is in from the West Coast, and she's trying to Airbnb her house. So I'm driving down to offer whatever physicality I can to repair holes in walls or whatever it is I'm supposed to do. I don't know yet. I'm just reporting for duty. But I get away from the program a little bit. I get a little lost. I feel a little bit off the beam. And it's funny, like Jimmy was saying, like, I want to curse Chuck. Chuck asked me, quote unquote, to do the newsletter, which it's not that I hate it. That's not the right word. But it's a pain in the ass is what it is. And I was traveling and I ordered the newsletter from the UPS store like we always do. And my wife went to go pick it up and it wasn't available. And it was this whole thing and got delayed and blah, blah, blah. So I go in yesterday, I have the wedding and I get ready and I go to the UPS store. I carve out some time. I go in there to like figure it out. Like we paid for it. The district paid for it. Like, hey, can I have the newsletter I paid for? And I wasn't a jerk, you know, probably the right level of caffeine. But I go in and I'm like, hey, I've got this receipt. Like, you know, what's the deal? And this guy comes out of the back and like, he's a little bigger than me. Not that that's hard to do. We've talked about that. But he kind of gets in my face and is like, I already talked to you and the thing doesn't work, blah, blah. You need the USB drive, the whole thing. I'm like, so I take a step in and I lean into him. Like, if you're going to lean into me, I'm going to lean into you, all 5'7" of me, okay? And like, it could get ugly quick. Like, we could start yelling at each other. And that didn't happen. Like, I saw what was going on. I kind of, like, vocally backed off a little bit. And just said, hey, look, I got this problem. You know, can we fix it? Like, what do I need to do? I got the newsletter printed. I tell that story, though, because when I get away from the program because I'm, quote, unquote, busy, I have these other obligations, whatever they are, email, treasury, newsletter, whatever, speaking. And they keep me centered. They remind me of the path. They remind me of my connection. They remind me of the time that I put into this thing and how I don't want to let it go and how great my life is on so many different levels. Another little caveat in that sort of same vein was I was on this job this whole week. I'm not a film person. But I got hired to work at Fisher Price as like a film crew grip. Grip is basically someone who like, instead of lighting, like knuckles and Hollywood arms and scrims and all this stuff. I told Fisher Price when they hired me 8 years ago, 7 years ago, whatever it is, that I know a little bit about this world as a still photographer, but it's not what I do for a living. And they're like, yeah, that's fine. You'll do. And I've been there ever since. So anyway, this week we were on this really big production. I hired these union guys from Rochester and some of the crew I know and some of them I don't. And, you know, it was a really big, fast moving pace thing. And they're yelling out numbers. They've got this whole language that I don't really understand, but I'm like, I'm trying to keep up. And this one guy that I've worked with a lot, he's the key grip. So he's basically one of my bosses. And he didn't talk to me, right? He was kind of like, hey, dum-dum. Like, go move the thing. Like, why'd you set it up that way, dum-dum? Like, you know, there's a right and wrong way to do it. You screwed up, dummy. That's what I heard. He probably didn't say it like that. That's what I heard in my head. And I'm trying not to swear. We talked about this. You guys know I have other words, but I'm trying to couch this. But, and I felt small. And I felt dumb. And I felt I got it wrong and all this stuff. And in my head, I was like, this guy's canceled. I'm not going to work for Fisher Price anymore. I'm not going to work with him. Like, this is all dumb. Like, I don't want to do it anymore. I'm over it. And his birthday was, well, two things. First of all, his birthday was yesterday, and I sent him a happy birthday. And I recommended him for another job, actually, which is pretty funny. And then there was a wrap party, and I went to the wrap party. He came to me at the end of the wrap party. He said, "Hey, you know, I know this isn't your usual assignment, but you did really good. You really kept up, and we really appreciate your hard work. And I apologize if I was hard on you, or I gave you the wrong tone or whatever." It's like, wow. And the thing that it really made me think about was how I talk to my wife, how I might bark at her or give her a crappy tone, right? Or like, "Hey, just move it. Just do the dishes. You know how many times I've done dishes today? Can't you do the dishes?" And it's just like, yeah, I don't know. I get to like have that pause, that little lesson, that little, I don't know, just a beat. Just take a beat. Have the trust that it's going to stick to the track. We're going to get around this turn. It's going to be just fine, you know? And if I can pause long enough, and usually the kink in the road works out just fine. So that was a little lesson. See where I am on my list. Hopefully I can yield the table back here. So I said, "Joe, oh yeah, so this is the last thing and probably the most important one." Maybe 2 weeks ago, my sister, I have a half sister from another marriage, and I'm a lot older than her. She could be to my daughter. And I don't know if it's fools. I don't know if it's the right word, but I like to say maybe I don't suffer fools well, even though I am one most of the time. She's a kid. I think she just turned 21, and she's been pretty rudderless. She hasn't had much of a strong example in her life. I mean, my father's dead, but when he was alive, he wasn't exactly a role model. Anyway, I don't cut her a lot of slack. She's very much one of these kids these days. You know, she dropped out of college and just been rudderless. And I see a lot of potential in her. And I have this fatal flaw that if I see the potential in anybody, but when you don't live up to it, I tend to hold you accountable. Like, that's pretty messed up. Like, I'm going to hold you accountable for the potential that you haven't received yet or reached. Like, that's not right. Anyway, she joined the Air Force, and I definitely didn't think she was going to make it through basic training, but she did. She passed. And now she's, I forget what they call it, but she's in her I guess tech school. And I went to the graduation, and now she's in tech school. And about 2 weeks ago, she messaged me, and she said, texted me. She said, "How do you know when it's a good time to stop drinking?" Like, what are you talking about? She's like, I thought you'd be a good person to ask. You know, I told the story and said, first of all, you know, if you're asking that question, you probably know the answer. You know, and it's such a delicate thing. You know, someone comes to you with something like that, especially a sister who is angsty and doesn't really want to talk to you about much of anything in the world. Plus, she's a woman, and I don't understand really anything about how women work at all. And to get to ask that question, like, I want to make sure I answer it correctly. Just like talking to you guys, I want to make sure I say the right thing. Even though there is no such thing as the right thing or wrong thing, it's just the thing. But I told her, I was like, you know, I told her my story. I was like, you know, when I was like 13, 14, you know, I had my stomach pumped and I kept drinking, wasted 25 years of my life. And we kind of had this back and forth. Now, I don't know where she's at in her journey. We talked a little bit about like how much drinking was going on in the barracks and then, you know, in their downtime and that kind of thing. And she was voicing that she didn't want to be part of it. She put him, quote, "didn't want to waste that time." You know, she wanted to maximize her time there and her time in the world and the time that she has, you know, and that's pretty profound for a 21-year-old kid. And bait in tech school to have. But I was just floored that she would come to me with that question. That's where my life has come. It's this, that's the arc from being completely lost and trying to evade the uncomfortability of life to leaning into it, you know? And I try to lean into it And when I don't want to do it, whatever the thing is that I don't want to do, doing the dishes, cleaning the dog poop in the yard, talking to a group of dudes on a Sunday morning. I got things to do. I'm an important person. It turns out I'm not that important, but I'm right where I'm supposed to be exactly at that moment. And because I'm sober, I get to experience that moment in real time. And I will yield my time back to the floor. And thank you, Jimmy, for having me. And thank you guys for doing what you do. Keep me sober. Thanks, boys.
Thank you, Stephen. I appreciate you taking the time. My name is Jim. I'm an alcoholic. I appreciate you taking the time. I know you had something pop up and you had to be in the car today, but I appreciate you taking the time to continue to do service work and to share your message with us. I really do appreciate that. I loved when you said, "Don't." I don't know what you just said a few.